This week's sponsor is When Change Happens, a podcast series about ordinary South Africans coping with extraordinary changes in their lives and hosted by legendary journalist Ruda Landman. Subscribe to Change in One Generation on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Iono, or go to changepodcasts.co.za for more information. Welcome to True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to a review of the new Showmax series, The Station Strangler, and an interview with director Nadine Klutter. If you've been a True Crime South Africa listener for a while, you'll have heard me mention the serial murderer moniker, The Station Strangler, many times in different contexts. I also covered the case really early on in the podcast journey. No, don't go look for that episode now. Just keep listening. It's a case that's horrified and terrified South Africans since the 1980s. And for one specific community of the Western Cape, Mitchell's Plain, the Station Strangler has become synonymous with the faceless monster who haunted the sand dunes, railway stations, and game arcades in the area, hunting down vulnerable young boys. But then the terrifying phantom was given a face, that of Norman Afzal Simons, who would eventually be convicted for just one of the murders in a series which was believed to have had at least 22 victims. Even with Simons behind bars, though, talk of the Strangler has never ceased, because there are many, many people who don't believe that Norman Simons was the Strangler. As you might know, Simons was recently released on parole, and this undoubtedly stirred up the old feelings around this series of murders again. So when I saw that Showmax, in collaboration with Idea Candy, was producing a new documentary film about this case, I was intrigued. Whenever a new South African true crime documentary, podcast, book, or any other piece of content comes out, I'm always slightly hesitant, as I never know whether it's going to be the one that takes us completely off course as a country in producing victim-centred true crime content. But having worked with Idea Candy myself several times, when I saw their name, I already felt assured that I would be watching an ethically produced, victim-focused production. And I was not disappointed. The documentary explores various aspects of this case, which the vast majority of us have probably never even thought about. It places the Strangler series at the point in South Africa's history during which it occurred, and highlights the peculiarities and effects of that time. It also provides an important insight into the families who lost their boys so many decades ago, and how that generational trauma has impacted the brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers, grandparents, cousins, and community members through the years, and in almost all their interactions with the outside world. I'll comment more on a few aspects of this documentary throughout my interview, but I will say that it's definitely a must-watch. I will also say that since the release of Norman Simons from prison, I've been thinking about redoing my episode on this case, and this documentary has convinced me to do it. So definitely go watch The Station Strangler on Showmax, and then in the next few weeks, you'll be ready for my revisitation of this case in a full episode. Maybe even two parts. Making a documentary like The Station Strangler is a mammoth undertaking. Trust me, having now seen behind the scenes of some of these productions, your mind would be blown at how much goes into making something that you consume in 90 minutes. I was so fascinated by the way the content was put together in this piece that when I got the opportunity to chat with the director, Nadine Klutter, I jumped at it. Nadine Klutter is a filmmaker whose projects often focus on themes of identity and heritage. Some of her previous projects include Action Commandant, Address Unknown, Miseducation, and Net Aunts, Just Us. She's incredibly accomplished and passionate about the work she does, and she's also a very cool human being. Here's my chat with Nadine. From what I could find about the projects you've worked on, and please correct me if I'm wrong, this is the first true crime type documentary you've done, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. My very first. I think those that I've done in the past have been mostly historical, have been mostly about, you know, issues of identity. And so, yeah, this is my very first true crime genre.
And what are your personal feelings as a human being and then also as a creator around the true crime genre?
Yeah, I think the true crime genre, as we spoke, there is the concern, right, that it will glorify perpetrators, you know, that it builds this kind of strange legacy around perpetrators. And like in America, Jeffrey Dahmer, for example, he has done horrendous things, yet his name is in their, ingrained in their pop culture. His name is raised in pop songs, rap songs. And I mean, that's the disturbing part of the genre and how it infiltrates into pop culture. And for me as a person, then being approached by Dear Candy to kind of step into the genre, I felt the victims is had to be told first and centered in the narrative, because the victims came from a very particular community at a very specific time in South African history. And so that could not be swept under the rug if we had to choose between do we dig deeper into a perpetrator or do we look at the community. And so I feel like with the Station Strangler, we balanced that quite well and went into that quite intentionally, very consciously doing that.
Were there any sort of worries that you had around approaching the true crime genre for the first time in film form? Were there maybe concerns that you had about what might be necessary for the genre that might not sit well with you as a person?
Yeah, look, digging deep into those crime scenes was not pretty. As you know, there are things that you see when you do your research, and not all of it makes the film. Some of it is too sensitive for viewers to see, and then you see it. I feel that, not to compare crimes, but maybe just to compare the experience, you know, I had done the documentary about Ashley Creel a few years ago, and I'd seen things with Ashley's crime scene that didn't necessarily make the film because it was too sensitive for the family and, of course, too sensitive then for public consumption. And having done that, I think it helped me step into this genre. Not that anything can prepare you, but you have a bit of that background. So dealing with then the realities of the crime scenes, I mean, it's completely shocking. And I grew up with this myth of the Station Strangler. But then to have those cases front and center in front of me, it was very disturbing because now it's no longer the boogeyman story. It's very much real. Yeah, diving into this genre, it's something that you need to be prepared for, because I think as much as you are crafting a narrative, which is the same in any film that you do, you craft a narrative, but you have to go into the details of the case, and then you have to go meet the people who participated very intimately in the case. So you need to be psychologically, emotionally prepared for that. And I just want to thank Idea Candy for creating the atmosphere for me to do that. I think that as a director, as a creative, I very often wear many hats on a production. And with Idea Candy, I was allowed to just be the director. And I want to thank them for that, because it allowed me to come in, hold the space, right? Because you're not just holding the space for yourself, you're holding the space for whoever you are interviewing as well, but to also allow a sense of vulnerability. And you can't do that if you're thinking about a million other things. So because I was Even the space to just be a director, I could bring that part of me into the room. So that is a very tricky thing to get right. And I feel that we got it right. And again, hats off to Idea Candy, Vim, Al, Roland, Clorinda, all of them, Kim as well, Kim Clutter, for doing that work, creating the space. Because look, a lot of people in other reviews, they've also commented on the sensitivity with which the story was told. And that's not easy with something so gruesome, to keep it sensitive. And it can only be done when you are supported by a good team. And your fears and all of that can only be supported again by a great team. And they created that atmosphere for me. And I feel like, although this was my first true crime genre, that my previous work that delved into history, that delved into identity, also the identity of a specific community, a community of color, that helped. And when I spoke to the producers and asked, listen, can I lean into certain directions? Can I lean into the politics? Can we explore that? They were like 100% yes on everything, everywhere that I wanted to go. And they are such experts as in the genre, but they really allowed me to make it my own. So I think that's the way you create a successful working environment and the feeling that you want. Even the first, when I met up with the editor, Nikki, the first assembly she had created, it was spot on the feeling that I wanted. So the mood, the sensitivity, the pace, everything, she had it down. Many things changed, of course, after the assembly, but the feeling was there. And she said, you know, that she could sense it from the material. And the only reason you sense it from the material is because the whole platform was created for a director, for the creative team to feel that safe.
I know you've said that when you discovered which case Idea Candy had in mind, you were a little taken aback because it was a case that had touched so many people's lives and continued to haunt them. Were there any misconceptions that you had had about the Station Strangler series coming into this that you found to be untrue when you started looking at the evidence?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think when I was first told the subject matter is the Station Strangler, the very first image that came to my mind was how the community went to search on the dunes. Because I remember that being front page news, even as a youngster, a child, I remember that, the news, the searching on the dunes. I mean, it's very scary because you know that they are searching for dead bodies. That was the reality. So that's the first image that came to mind when I heard that it was the Station Strangler subject matter. And any misconceptions, I think the challenges around the perpetrator and why people had such different opinions, that was interesting to me. And not that it perhaps clarified anything, but it again brought it front and center into understanding Norman Simons in a more nuanced way. Let me put it that way. You know, there was the myth, right? The Station Strangler myth. Then there was the person. But then there were also questions around the person. And I think delving into the subject matter, delving into the research, helped me understand Norman Simons in a more nuanced way. I didn't know things about his own history, his own abuse that came to the fore. And those were things that were quite new to me.
Something that I've learned over the last 5 years of covering South African cases is that there's always this deep impact of socioeconomic and cultural factors in crimes, regardless of the type. And I found that the area in which a case or series of crimes occurs often makes a big difference to the type of crime and the way it's investigated. Were these impacts clear to you before you started looking deeply into this case, or were there aspects of this that only revealed themselves over time?
Definitely. I think many things struck me. Look, when the killings started, right? This was happening, that started in the 80s. So when these killings started, Mitchell's Plain was only about 10 years old as a community. Right. And the people that lived there, they had been people who were forcibly, people of color that were forcibly removed from various areas, but also first-time homeowners. So it was a very new community. Right. And then, as Crystal Orderson also explains in the film, that Mitchell's Plain itself then had all these structures or hierarchies of class. And what is interesting, and then what I learned from her, as you think, what I learned that I didn't realize, because you think, oh, you knew these murders were happening on the Cape Flats, Mitchell's Plain, the majority of these murders didn't take place in Mitchell's Plain. But what you don't realize, or what I learned rather, was that those boys were even taken from the very poorer communities within Mitchell's Plain, right? And so when Mickey Pistorius talks about the perpetrator area, you realize then that the selection of where he took the boys and where those boys were coming from was not innocent. It was somebody who decided on Mitchell's Plain and decided on the most poorer areas of Mitchell's Plain because he knew that the justice, the police structures at that time would not worry about these boys. So that all of that, Nathan Trantrell speaks about how the apartheid system almost gifted these boys to the perpetrator. And that is true. It's sad, but it's a truth we explored.
And I think that's something that we see all over the world, really. In any country in the world that has an indigenous population that's either been colonized or put under some sort of system of segregation or oppression at some point in their history, you'll still find this today. I mean, if you look at Canada, their serial killers often focus on their indigenous communities because they know for a fact that the police won't pay as much attention to individuals in those communities. Police might assume that the victims were drug addicts or alcoholics, especially if they're adult women. And that continues to happen all over the world, even still today. So I'm really, really glad that you guys brought that aspect of how this applies to this case into the film.
Yeah, which made the case, people ask, okay, why did you look at this case again? But the thing is, the issues, as you've raised, they still persist in today's society, and it's universal. So it's not just something that happens in South Africa. And had the community had the resources, had the police, the detectives had the resources in the 80s, the case could have been solved much faster, or they would have had more concrete evidence to work with as it moved into the 90s. Because the detectives that came on board then in the 90s, as I understood, could do very little with evidence gathered on the 80s case.
I'm also really thankful for the information that you included about how the National Party used this case for their own political agenda at the time. Of course, hasn't really stopped, and we still see politicians inserting themselves into criminal cases for votes and to appear to be helpful. I think in this case, though, it was outrageously inauthentic because these weren't just bad politicians. They were quite literally the reason that these cases went uninvestigated in the first place. Why do you think that it was so important to include that in the docu and for viewers to understand that?
Thanks. And talk about surprises when J.D. Kotze, the lead detective of the Station Strangler Unit, when even he said, yes, there were politics involved in this case. And that is how he was a white policeman, and that's why he got on board on he was brought onto the case. But even he said, yes, there were politics involved. As a policeman, as a professional, he didn't allow the politics to get him and serve the community of Mitchell's Plain the best way that he could. But we can't deny that the politics, and remember, it was 1994 as well, played a huge role in the case. Played a role in the National Party, Ernest Krill specifically, increasing reward money for whoever could find the perpetrator. And then it's interesting to see that Ernest Krill then wins the Western Cape, after the 1994 elections. Not to say that this case had anything to do with the win, but I believe it could have played a major role because they had to be seen as having done something for the community. And they used this case in that way.
And I think for me, this is the reason that when people say, well, the crime stopped when they put Norman Simons in jail, I think we don't really know that, do we? Were young boys of color in other communities being killed? Were they just not being reported on?
Yeah, that's an interesting observation. And in my with my experience now of talking to certain people, even though the police were under immense pressure and, of course, the politics around the case, I'm of the opinion, and I know that it's debatable, but I am of the opinion that they caught the right person. And the reason why was centered a lot around my interviews with Mickey Pistorius, J.D. Kotzer, and also Marilise Rowler. And if I could just highlight some of the things that came from the interviews, right? So Mickey Pistorius did the criminal profile, right? He did the profile which was released to the public. When the perpetrator was caught, it fits a profile to a T, being a teacher, being of the community, being very charming, being very intelligent, all these sorts of things. Also, that a lot of information was released to the public with respects to how the boys were found, tied up, strangled, etc. But not everything was released to the public, yet those boys were found in exactly the same way, murdered in exactly the same way every single time. So it just had to be the same perpetrator. I know that there are theories that he was working in a group, but there's a methodology that they use and there's a psychology behind it. I mean, with Norman Simon specifically, right, it's mentioned in the documentary and Mickey Pistorius' further work that he was abused by his older brother as a child. That's why the victims were a certain demographic, a certain age, and he had to regain that power psychologically. So every time he killed these boys, he was in essence reenacting what had happened to him. And that speaks to a very specific person. It's very specific, not localized. It can't be repeated in the exact same manner, right? Also, the fact that they had released a newspaper article about bodies that were found. So the newspaper article spoke to victims and bodies that were found in the order that the police found them. And we use this order in the film as well. But they were not necessarily the order in which the boys were killed. And then in the serial killer's next killing, he had left a note to say number, I think 14 it was, in order to correct the police. Mm. So it was someone that was paying attention. It was very methodical. I think if the interview with Marilise Rowler also sparked certain things for me. She can't say for certainty whether Norman Simons is necessarily the station strangler. She was the judge that presided over the inquest, right, in the early 2000s. And she doesn't necessarily want to say that Norman Simons is the station strangler, but she does say that whoever killed Elroy van Rooyen, who is the person that Norman Simons was incarcerated for, she says whoever killed that person should be responsible for at least 6 other deaths, which she had in front of her, right? She had the cases, information on those cases in front of her, yeah. Which says that if you're responsible for at least 6 other deaths, you must be responsible for everything else that was listed under the station strangler crimes. I agree with you that there could be more, right? There was, and this didn't make the film, but there was a father who believed that his son was one of the station strangler victims, and that body was never found, but the boy went missing around that same time. And it is in public information that Norman Simons addresses the father and names the son and says, I'm sorry for your son, says the name. So while I believe that the right person was caught and that killing stopped in the same manner, let me put it that way, the same modus operandi, those that stopped. But I can agree with you and say that there could have been more, and those were not investigated due to politics and politics of race at the time. But yeah. In terms of the right person being caught, I do believe the right person was caught. If you look at Rowler's argument and you look at Mickey Pistorius's arguments.
I guess what you're looking at here, for the most part, was actually second generation grief and trauma. It was the brothers and sisters and the cousins. And that just goes to show that this type of violence and loss gets passed down through these generations.
Oh, yeah, because the people that we spoke to were aunts, nephews, nieces, siblings. Many of the mothers had passed on. And you can see grief, how grief just sits on one's bodies, right? Because many of the victims, family members of victims, rather, still live in the same communities and can be triggered and re-traumatized all the time. And one of the brothers of the victim speaks about how, because your parent then is not receiving the psychological help that they need, they are breaking down, and you as a child, you don't have that support. And so you kind of lash out, or you do different things to just try and get a sense of control. And so your life just takes, various turns that they wouldn't have had ordinarily. And I also think about how one sister, because their mother was so distraught, she actually quit school, to be able to assist the household and assist her mother. Now you can imagine the domino effect, even still years later. You didn't complete your schooling because of this event, and you still don't have that education. So you cannot live the life that you perhaps envisioned for yourself. And living the life that you envisioned was anyway limited because of the community that you are in. Yeah, the way trauma has sat on people. So that was very challenging to experience, to dive into, even with Reino that we interviewed. And I thank Reino and his aunt Florence for opening their houses and for giving us the time. But you can see how the release of Norman Simon, what psychological effect that has had on that family in particular. Because, he just got very quiet, very withdrawn, worried even about his own children. And I don't think that goes away. I just don't think that goes away, because the perpetrator or the alleged perpetrator has never spoken. And also that the families were just never given the support. And I think there's a level of anger because the perpetrator goes to prison, yet they're still, yes, while they are locked up, they do have access to education, protection, of meals. These are things that the families don't necessarily have the access to, not even a meal, right? These are some of the family members that we interview don't have their own phones. It is very challenging to be in contact with them. And I'm not saying a lot of it, let me put it that way. Yeah, a lot of it had to do with the families breaking down due to what happened to their brother, nephew, and the family's not having support to hold what has happened to them. Because look, on either side of the politics, whether it was the NP or whether it was the ANC coming to support, that support eventually dwindled, right? When the spotlight was off the case, that the people still continue living in the same conditions. So, yeah, that's a great question. And you see it on the faces of the people. Because look, if we think of the Somaia family, we all understand the role that an older sibling plays in the household. And Neville Somaia was an older brother to Alan Somaia. And when that gets taken away from you, sure, what a vacuum in your life. The same with the Kibero family, when Marcelino Kibero gets taken. Marcelino didn't even grow up in Mitchells Plain, but he visited there regularly. And the family unit just creates. Also, I want to add that apart from the family, it was this integration of an entire community. Because this was a community that was living with the my child is your child principle. Yet when these killings started happening, if an adult was walking alone with a child, especially an adult man, they became a suspect and people were trying to beat that person up. Whereas before you could see a child and take care of them or walk home with them. And I mean, that was the fabric of the community. That does not exist anymore as a direct line to this case. Kids had to be home. The kids had to be home by 4 p.m. where you had a community where children were playing openly outside. And many of these boys were taken from the game shops. And game shops, we can really break that down, what that meant to young boys in the community. It was a source of you playing there with your friends. It's time away. It's your time away from your parents. It's meant to be a safe haven for you. And now it becomes a place of violence. So apart from the families who could never recover psychologically because you're constantly re-traumatized, but Mitchell's Plain itself was just never the same.
I must say, I was blown away by the original footage that you managed to find. How on earth did you find that, and how difficult was it to get your hands on it and get permission to air it?
So the footage is a mix of SL, also what belonged to Coors Low, the lawyer's material. So getting access to it meant just speaking to a lot of people, spending time with it. Me and the production manager, Roland, we sat at the offices and went through those archives. It was actually really triggering to see those things because those were the headlines growing up. And then to be reminded of it was, yeah, quite something else. But they were needed, I think, for contextualization and for people to, again, identify, to be able to identify with that case again.
You mentioned how some of the scenes included in the docu weren't originally planned and actually developed organically, like the newspaper scene with the Samai family. I've heard other documentary filmmakers refer to this organic process happening and how it sort of seems to be part of the genre because you're telling a story. But if you do it well, the story will tell you what needs to be told. Have you found this to be true in your other film projects, or was it unique to this one?
Look, it happens in documentary, but I feel like it can only happen once the people that you are interviewing feel that they are collaborating with you, that they are co-collaborators. And again, I'm thankful to the Samai family that we could get to that place where I'm not just arriving here and I'm milking you for your story, that we could have a moment and you want to add what you want to give. And yeah, that scene happened. We were waiting on one of the other Samai siblings to arrive. She was running late and the sister Pam was there already and, you know, said that I have all these newspaper clippings. And we're like, what? So she brings them out and we immediately start filming. And then they come across this article where the mother claims that the killer left a note saying that the next little boy, the brother, is next. And that would have been Alan, who's busy reading the article. Now, whether that note that she received was a hoax or whether it was real, we cannot say. But I think it plays into the fear and the metaphor of what the Station Strangler became in that community. Well, yeah, what touched me most was about that and afterwards was because we took some of the newspapers, right, just in case we needed to scan them or whatever. We asked if we could take some of the newspapers with us and the family agreed. And then Pam texted me and she said, when are you going to return the newspapers? Because that's the only memory we have of our brother. Like, to her, those newspapers are Neville Samai. I was like, yo, that hit me, eh? Because they don't have an album of Neville. They don't have the luxury of that. So all that you see on that table in that scene, that is what they have of their brother. That is like, that's almost their album. It's their living testimony. That's their proof of my brother existed. And that's, so beyond just, oh, can I have the article back? It was like, I need this back because this is the way I'm remembering my brother. So yeah, that hit me deep.
From a legal perspective, because Norman Simons was never charged with the other 21 murders, he still could be charged with them. Do you think that the families who lost their boys will ever get any real answers?
So there was such an opportunity with the case that Marilee Rolo presided over. She talks about what is so sad that, like we mentioned, many people have passed on, and that includes eyewitnesses. So when Marilee Rolo presided over the case in the early 2000s, key eyewitnesses had already passed on. So there were two eyewitnesses, and one specifically in the case of Marcelino Kibido, where a witness had seen him in a car with Norman Simons. Granted, it was not the day that he disappeared, but it speaks to proximity. The same with another boy that was mentioned, where there was an eyewitness. That eyewitness was taken into custody by the police and then changed his statements, but Marilee's Rolo still had access to the original statements. So I would, in an ideal world, say yes, the family should still challenge, but my fear is that many eyewitnesses now have passed on and much evidence has been tampered with, destroyed. So I question, why wasn't Marilee's Rolo's statements just looked into more in depth, because she totally relied on prima facie evidence. She relied on the modus operandi of the killer, which was the same in the six cases she had presided over. And her case and her findings are to me. But even then, like I say, even at that time in 2005, the eyewitness statements that she was referring to, those people had already passed on. So that's my fear. Yes, I would like to say to those people, absolutely challenge, keep challenging and keep fighting for justice. Just my concern is what evidence is left. Yeah. And I mean, the only person that knows now is Norman Simons himself.
What have you taken away from this project personally?
Yeah, I think personally, it's a reminder of how justice, politics, and race are so interlinked. There was a lesson in that. And also something completely new to me were the lessons from Mickey Pistorius, the psychology of serial killers, and how nothing is black and white. It's very nuanced. So I also thank her for her contribution, because she's written many books and she's got her own drama series out, so she didn't really have to participate in this film. But I want to thank her for doing that, because it brought something to the film, something to a different audience. And what a learning experience it was speaking to her.
In closing, I asked Nadine if there was anything she wanted to share about the reaction she'd seen to the film or anything else.
Yeah, just to appreciate the people that do pick up on the sensitivity of the film. I appreciate that. I appreciate that even though I have my own feelings, that people have said the film is still quite balanced. So that was important for me. And yeah, I guess that people watch the film but not see it as, oh, this is something that happened back then, but it's very much still alive today. Our communities are still broken, still people living with trauma. And none of that is an innocent act.
Watching The Station Strangler has really motivated me to delve into each of these cases separately as much as possible. Another infamous South African case involving children comes to mind around this, and that's the alleged Gert van Rooyen and Joey Harthoff series. Whenever people ask me my opinion on that series of kidnappings and believed murders, I say that our biggest mistake was focusing solely on the assumption that Gert van Rooyen and Joey Harthoff were the only perpetrators. Instead of investigating each case on its own merits and then deciding whether they actually truly fit the perpetrator bill, we took the perpetrator and lumped all the victims in with them for decades. And I think that's one of the reasons we don't know the truth. Because we missed the trees while we were looking at the forest. Each and every victim deserved their own full investigation. And if the evidence from that investigation leads us to the same perpetrator, then so be it. And I feel exactly the same way about the Station Strangler series. As this documentary film clearly shows with such empathy and sensitivity, this is not over. It's not over in a myriad of ways. It's not over because 21 boys, and likely more than that, have no justice. It's not over because Norman Simons is now back out in the community. And for many, that is a terrifying thought, as we don't really know who he is. And it's definitely not over, nor will it probably ever be, for the people of Mitchell's Plain, whose entire way of life was shaped by the events of almost 3 decades before, and everything that it's meant since then. I highly recommend you head over to Showmax and check out The Station Strangler. A huge well done and thank you to Nadine, her team, and Idea Candy. Thanks again to this week's sponsor, When Change Happens. To hear amazing stories of change, go to changepodcasts.co.za. I'm sure you'll enjoy the show.